Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker. Confrontation between the U.S. and China looks set to intensify after the Trump administration approved a $1.4 billion arms sale to Taiwan, casting a shadow over Donald Trump's meeting with South Korea's President Moon Jae-in. Donald Trump's travel ban came back into effect late Thursday night after a Supreme Court ruling lifted an injunction on parts of the executive order. What comes next in the fight against the ban? A new escalation in Syria looks to be on the horizon, with Turkey possibly preparing an invasion of regions held by the Kurdish YPG in the northern region of Afrin, but the Kurdish forces are warning that they will put up fierce resistance. And we are very proud to announce that this show will be our very first broadcast on 105.5 FM in the Washington, D.C. area. But first we turn to President Moon's visit and the arms sale to Taiwan. We're joined from Norfolk, Connecticut by Patrick Lawrence. He is a columnist for The Nation and the author of Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century. Welcome back, Patrick.
Thank you, Walter. A pleasure, as always.
Thanks for joining. So the Trump administration set into motion a $1.4 billion arms sale to Taiwan yesterday, the same day that the new South Korean president, Moon Jae-in, arrived in Washington. I mean, is this a coincidence or is the U.S. trying to signal something here?
It's hard to say, Walter. The Trump administration is anybody's read. If I can put this into a little context, it's not just the Moon summit and the Taiwan arms sale back to back. Let's go back to Tuesday. Let's go back 1 week. Trump announced, as usual on Twitter, that he was grateful for Xi Jinping's efforts with North Korea, but rather disappointed it didn't work out, right, as he put it, right? At least he tried. That was his Twitter message, okay? So he tossed in the towel. To me, that was an admission, I don't have a China policy. The only thing I tried failed, okay? So to me, you need to go then to next Tuesday. Secretary of State Tillerson issued an annual report on human trafficking and downgraded China to the third and lowest tier, okay, among the worst offenders. That was Tuesday. Wednesday, three administration officials told Reuters, any day now we're ready to declare the American steel industry a national security question, and that will open the door for import tariffs on Chinese steel. Right? That's Wednesday. Then Thursday, the arms sale. It's a lot in a week. I cannot read it. I don't think it indicates necessarily a new China policy, and we can talk about why. But then you throw in the summit with Moon. Everybody's on the same side, desiring to reduce tensions on the Korean Peninsula and ultimately denuclearize. Good. Not everybody is on the same side by way of how to get that done. I think Trump had a good opportunity to signal to Moon, look, we will move in the direction of negotiation without preconditions. It's the only way forward. We'll have to see what comes now. The Moon summit appears to be just kind of a feeling each other out exercise.
Right. And, you know, Donald Trump, when he was speaking beside President Moon, he said the era of strategic patience with the North Korean regime has failed. Now, that's not a new announcement, right? I mean, Donald Trump has been saying things to that effect for a while. But, I mean, it does indicate, or he's reiterating the belligerence that he has towards the North, towards the DPRK. I mean, what is Trump referring to when he says strategic patience? And, you know, we may not see a coherent policy in its place, but what might come in its place?
Walter, it's a very good question. Strategic patience, from the first I heard it, is a silly euphemism they used, they decided upon in Washington to refer to the fact that we don't know what to do. We haven't known what to do for years, and we're going to have to call it something that sounds smart. So they went into their diplomatic dictionaries and came up with strategic patience. There's no such thing as strategic patience. It's a silly phrase. What it means is we don't have a policy and we have to get one. What we've seen ever since the first use of this term is a kind of groping or flailing. Nobody knows what to do, right? Let me give a little more context to your listeners, okay? Asia policy is easily the most complex that Washington has to manage. There are many, many moving parts. There's trade, there's investment, there's security, there's diplomacy, there's politics. And there are differences among Asian nations that may or may not have anything to do with the United States. All that has to be managed, and it's not easy. Second point, since 1945, or let's just say at the latest, since the onset of the Cold War in the late 40s, 47, we can say. The Pentagon has run Asia policy more or less. That's a fairly bald statement, but cutting to the chase, that's how it's worked. This is a hangover from the 1945 victories, MacArthur in Tokyo, etc. So we have watched for a long time, but I will say very, very clearly, since Trump came to office, the Pentagon wants one thing in Asia and usually gets its way. State Department wants another thing. The Treasury Department wants something further. Commerce Department wants something further. And there's insufficient coordination. These are kind of, if you will, silo institutions. They're not talking sufficiently to one another. There's not enough institutional memory, and there's not enough coherence in the policy process. So all this figures into what we're watching now, right? The Pentagon went ahead with the THAAD anti-missile system, knowing it was going to create problems, political problems with the incoming administration. Moon Jae-in is dead against it, right? He's trying to ameliorate the situation now. But they went ahead anyway, never mind what the diplomats might say, right? So I don't think we can say, certainly there has not been a policy. Let's dispose of strategic patience. And I don't think we can say we have a policy yet. We have a series of uncoordinated moves, most of which I find unfortunate.
Now, even if it's not like a coherent policy, and I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense. And of course, you know, in every area of diplomacy, there are competing factions and currents within any administration. But it certainly has a similar effect. All these moves that you laid out, they had a similar effect of ratcheting it up tensions in East Asia. I mean, the Chinese embassy in Washington said in a statement in reference to the Taiwan arms deal, which I want to turn to now. It's a $1.4 billion arms sale to Taiwan. You know, the Congress still has to approve it, but it was given its initial go-ahead by the Trump administration. The Chinese embassy said, "The Chinese government and Chinese people have every right to be outraged." I mean, tell us about how this is going to sort of add fuel to the fire.
Well, it was not a necessary move. There is not a great deal of hostility between Taipei and Beijing at this time. Sometimes there is, sometimes there's not. But for a great long while now, there has not been. It was unnecessary. The timing, you do have to wonder, what are they thinking? Where to take it from here? Well, Trump was told straight out when he had that conversation with the incoming president of the Republic of China, Taiwan, look, don't tamper with one China. I will go back to a conversation we had at that time. My view is I don't think Trump gives a hoot about these high-end geostrategic questions, right? Taiwan Straits and so forth. He's after trade. Right. He's after trade. His theme is jobs and American people. They have nothing to do with Taiwan. I think back then my analysis was he doesn't really care about Taiwan. He's giving Xi Jinping a clap on the head, saying, look, I'm positioning myself for some heavy-going trade negotiations. Here's my opening move, right? And indeed, he stepped back from that when it was opportune to do so. I think if there is any coherence to these various moves that have been made in the past week, the human trafficking report, what came next? Oh, yeah, Commerce Secretary Ross is going to get into steel tariffs any day now, and now the arms sale. I think if there's any coherence to it at all, and that's a capital IF, it may have to do with Trump once again saying, okay, I've got to have some tough trade. I've got to show something for all my promises during the campaign to remake China relations with China, and it's time to start again on the trade side. So let's make some noise and get them nervous in Beijing, and then they'll be perfectly unrelaxed when they get to the table, and we'll get something substantive out of them. That's what I think.
There's a very powerful pro-Taiwan lobby in the United States, and I think it's strongest amongst Republicans. If Trump is primarily focused on trade and domestic issues, and you know, I think you make a pretty good case for that, for sure, is the Taiwan lobby sort of stepping into the void here and encouraging things like the arms sale? And tell us about the pro-Taiwan lobby, too. I mean, how powerful are they?
Well, I think the Taiwan lobby, it dates to Mao. Mao took Beijing in October 49. It dates to that. Who lost China was the big question after that. There was a great house cleaning in the State Department. A lot of very worthy people lost their jobs because they were soft on Mao, right? The KMT fled to Taiwan. And
that's the Nationalist Party, right?
Yes, I beg your pardon. Yeah. They fled to Taiwan, declared the Republic of China, ROC, as opposed to the People's Republic. And Taiwan lobby came into its own at that time. It was a Cold War phenomenon, straight out. It figured in all the Cold War thinking, the domino theory and drawing the line here, otherwise it'll spread everywhere and so on and so forth, right? The Taiwan lobby, being a creature of the Cold War, I don't think has nearly the coherence it used to have. It was at one time a rather powerful bloc on Capitol Hill with all kinds of identifiable people. I don't think it's that any, I think its great day has passed. Yes, there are hawks and vigorous defenders of Taiwan, I suppose people like Senator McCain, right? But it's not, let's say, Walter, it's not the grand theme it used to be. Taiwan, we must protect Taiwan. No, I think probably pro-Taiwan people in Washington will be heard now that this arms sale has been authorized by the White House and goes to Capitol Hill for ratification. Yes, we will hear from them. But they are a little bit swamped by greater considerations, mostly because the relationship with China now, the mainland, is nothing like what it was during the Cold War. We have all kinds of unpleasant things to say about the Chinese, but we are heavily, heavily invested in Deng Xiaoping's reforms and all that. We're not talking about, you know, East-West tensions in the way we were when the Taiwan lobby was prominent.
And you could sort of say the same thing about China-South Korea relations too, right? I mean, even though China is the historic ally of North Korea, there's a great deal of trade that happens between China and South Korea. I mean, it kind of makes sense. I mean, going back to Moon's visit and the broader picture of U.S.-China relations and the situation in East Asia, I mean, it kind of makes sense that, you know, if Donald Trump and Moon were talking about, well, you know, what are the possibilities, what are the prospects for negotiations over peace and denuclearization, could China be a fair broker there?
Yes. All the lines we grew accustomed to during the Cold War are now blurred. I remember when I was a correspondent out in Asia reporting, let me figure it out, it must have been 85, 6, 7, reporting the first shipments, the first trade shipments from merchandise shipments between South Korea and China. It was a very big deal. A number of correspondents spent a lot of time digging around among the diplomats and so forth. And it was something. Wow, China and South Korea. That's all now very well established. When the Pentagon began installing the anti-missile system called THAAD, the Chinese were quite upset, and they leaned very heavily on the South Koreans. I cannot think but they were very pleased with Moon's election, right? They are, as I wrote in a column just the other day, I don't know whether they are into sort of full-dress sunshine policy such as Moon Jae-in is talking about, you know, industrial parks and cross-border exchanges of all sorts and all that. I'm not sure. I don't know whether the Chinese are on for all that or not. But I do know they are entirely behind the new government in South Korea on the question of how to get through this, and that is peaceably at the negotiating table. And tone down the military side entirely. Indeed, months ago, Beijing, the foreign minister in Beijing came out and said, here's what you should do. It was on the eve of annual military exercises conducted by the U.S. and South Korea. They've been going on for ages, right? So here's what you should do. This year, call them off, right? This was greeted in Washington and in our slavishly repeating media as the silliest damn thing anybody could possibly say. Absolutely not. It was not silly. It was a clear reflection of Beijing's position on this question. I am sure now they are behind the new Moon administration in Seoul, and it's right. That's most important.
Thank you very much. We've been talking to Patrick Lawrence. We're all out of time. Patrick Lawrence is a columnist for The Nation, and he's the author of Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century. I'm Walter Smolarik, filling in for Brian Becker. We'll be back.
Loud and clear. Loud and clear.
Welcome back. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarik, filling in for Brian Becker. Donald Trump's travel ban comes back into effect late Thursday night after a Supreme Court ruling lifted an injunction on parts of the executive order. What comes next in the fight against the ban? And we are discussing this on our very first broadcast on 105.5 FM in the Washington, D.C. area. We're joined from Palm Springs by award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist Ted Rall. Welcome back, Ted.
Thanks for having me.
So Trump's travel ban, or perhaps an amended version of it, came back into effect last night, 8 p.m. Eastern time. What's the fallout been so far? I mean, are we seeing the same kind of outrage that came after the initial executive order?
No, we're not. It seems like the reaction at the nation's airports, whether it be JFK or LAX, has been notably tamped down over what we saw the first time. And it's only possible to speculate why, but hey, that's what I'm paid for. I'm going to say that the dog days of summer have an effect on these things. A lot of people are away on vacation, and that includes politically minded activists, and it's hard to get people organized. I think just inherently, the second time something happens, there's not as much of a sense of crisis as the first time. And then I think also the fact that the ban appears to be has been marketed as more limited scope and perhaps less extreme may have had somewhat of an effect at tamping things down. But I think it's also the fact that the Trump administration is now entering its sixth month in office, and the original ban was something that went down very quickly in a matter of weeks, really, after the administration took over. So people are, you know, we're in a heightened state of anxiety over what the president might do at that time. Now there's sort of a sense of perhaps more, slightly more normalized feeling of what this administration is and what it's going to be for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, it's only been 6 months, but it seems like it's been, I don't know, years. I mean, it really seems like, you know, every day that there's a new development. And of course, people get sort of ground down by that over time. I agree with you that the time of the year is also not very favorable for mobilization. But I mean, take us back to what the political climate was like in January, in late January, early February. I mean, there was like a shock and awe offensive that the travel ban was one component of, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, this administration came in, couldn't possibly have represented more of an existential ideological threat to the wide sweep of the American left, from moderate Democrats all the way out to really more left wing people. And at the time, the announcement was that Obamacare would be immediately repealed. There was the travel ban. There was just a host of attacks on Obama era and Democratic and liberal and progressive agenda items that were just seemed to be coming fast and furious. And then things there was trouble passing things. You know, we're seeing that the administration is still trying to pass Trump Care, or which is just, you know, non-Obamacare, and then they don't seem to be having any luck with that. They had to postpone the vote in the Senate the way that they had to postpone the vote in the House earlier in the year. So it's just, so I think it is true what you said, Walter. There's definitely going to be more of a sense of normalization. Just, this is the new reality. You know, it's like, I did a cartoon that came out a couple of days ago where it's a riff on the old joke about the restaurant. You know, it's the food's terrible and such small portions. That's what the Trump administration feels like. You know, it's like the agenda is terrible, and they're so ineffective at carrying it out.
And there's another element of it that I want to introduce and get your opinion on. I mean, in those early days, which actually before Trump was even inaugurated, right? I mean, there were massive demonstrations night after night after night, right after the November election. I mean, in those relatively earlier days, it was about the Trump agenda, right? It was like about the horrible reactionary policies that everybody expected Donald Trump and did what he did, in fact, implement, you know, the anti-immigrant measures, the travel ban, attacks on healthcare. I mean, it was very sort of like politically minded. It was very like issue oriented, and people were fighting back with like concrete political demands. But now it seems to me that opposition to Trump is more about like Trump, the personality. You know, Trump is somebody who recklessly tweets and endangers our national security and our foreign policy strategies as if those were, you know, good things for the world. And Trump is a secret agent of Vladimir Putin. He's a Russian Manchurian candidate. And that's why we really have to oppose Trump, the person. It's not about the Trump agenda. It's about Trump, the individual. Do you think that plays a role?
Oh, well, it definitely plays a role. I mean, we saw it with the hysteria over the Mika Brzezinski tweet from a couple of days ago. And it is highly personalized. And in that sense, it is an echo of some of the authoritarian states that I've visited over the years, and where people become very fat. Policy sort of just goes away. I mean, of course, policy exists, but people don't pay as much attention to policy as they do to the personality of dear leader, as they are doing here in the United States with Trump. I mean, I think subtly and interestingly, the threat to democracy is less what Trump is doing as a president, or I should say ineffectively trying to do as president, and more about the fact that we've personalized the office of the presidency to such an extreme extent and so quickly in a country where no man was or woman was held to be above the law. Even Richard Nixon famously was believed to have been held accountable for Watergate. And now you just have this situation where we really kind of have single man, albeit strange man, rule.
So the Democratic Party clearly had a role in reorienting their base, or, you know, the people who would maybe hold their noses and vote for the Democratic Party. You know, they have these hearings that, you know, are of course, chaired by Republicans, but egged on and, you know, demanded that they go further, the hearings into the Russiagate so-called investigations. There's the constant media appearances where they say, oh, you know, Donald Trump needs to release his taxes because, you know, we need to see who's paying him bribes. I mean, the Democratic Party establishment leadership, I think, has a significant role to play or has a significant share of the burden to shoulder for the reorientation of a large part of the anti-Trump movement in this personalistic direction that we've been talking about. Do you see it that way? Do you think that was an intentional strategy? Do you think that's something that was just sort of an arrangement of convenience?
I think it's an arrangement of convenience, but I think it has some really negative short and long term implications, just for the Democratic Party, just purely from a tactical vantage point. In my view, any opposition party is always best served by presenting a slate of policies that showcase to voters exactly how things would be different if they were in charge on every single issue. So if Trump wants to make certain changes to healthcare, they shouldn't be just rethink what, you know, that Trump is wrong or that things are fine the way they are. They should be talking about how they would improve healthcare and so on. But they're not doing that. They're running a rear guard defensive action, and it's, you know, it's kind of baffling just as a political observer who's worked in campaigns, because historically this has never worked. It never, ever, ever works. It won't work. It can't work. And Democrats really have a lot of advantages right now in the political arena. I mean, Trump's approval rating is running around 35% to 38%. This is spectacularly low for a 6-month president. The policies are obviously not able to get off the ground. Maybe nobody's choking the airports over the travel ban, but they certainly don't like Trump care. Even Republicans are feeling the heat on that. So, and you would just think that Democrats would be able, if not now, when, to present an alternative. They should be presenting an alternative viewpoint of what the United States should look like, and they just don't seem to be able to do anything other than Trump sucks, which, frankly, is not much of a platform.
So does that mean they're in for a surprise in 2018? I mean, they're all expecting to win in 2018.
Yeah, if I were them, I wouldn't be cocky about anything. On the morning of Election Day last year, to win big, the New York Times had a 90% chance of Hillary Clinton winning. And I hear the same kind of cockiness. So it's a heavy lift anyway. But I think people have a tendency to return incumbents to power. It's very unusual to, I mean, I know there's a midterm correction that can happen if there's widespread displeasure with a president, but this is a mixed bag. Famous midterm corrections occurred during recessions or economic downturns. 1974 followed Watergate, yes, but it was also at the beginning of the energy crisis. If you look at 1994, the recession was still lingering under Bill Clinton, and even though the economy was starting to move, there was still a lot of pain, and people felt like the recovery wasn't coming fast enough. I think that the same thing with Bush in 2006, when the Democrats had enjoyed gains in Congress in the midterm correction. And again, the economy was starting to tank. We were headed into the beginning of the foreclosure crisis. So I just don't see what they're thinking. The economy isn't sucking enough for Democrats to have this kind of confidence. And just Trump insults Mika Brzezinski, or Trump might have known someone who knew Putin, is just not real. I'm not going to predict anything, but I think they're way too confident.
And I mean, looking beyond just 2018 and the arrangement of Congress, I mean, if we take a look at the Supreme Court decision that allowed or lifted the injunction partially on big parts of the travel ban executive order, it was a unanimous decision, which Trump was, of course, bragging about. I mean, we can discuss whether or not this is really the huge victory that he presents it as being. I think it is certainly a setback for progressive people, but three of the Supreme Court justices, Neil Gorsuch, Clarence Thomas, and Samuel Alito, dissented from the ruling, not because they thought that the injunction could stay, of course, or should stay, of course, but because they thought that the entirety of the executive order should be able to go into effect. I mean, is this an indicator that we're looking at for a long period of time, perhaps many, many years or even decades, a hard right Supreme Court that progressive people will also need to focus their activism towards?
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I mean, you know, I always fantasize about what French President Charles de Gaulle did when he became president after liberation from Germany in 1944. He passed one of the first laws, if not the first law he passed, was one that simply invalidated every act of legislation that had occurred between 1940 and 1944 under Vichy. I would love to see something like that after a debacle like a Trump or a Bush administration, but that's not our system. These things stick around. I mean, even Richard Nixon's Supreme Court justices got to keep their jobs and rule on cases for decades afterwards. So yeah, we're going to have Gorsuch for years. We're going to have a hard Supreme Court. And one of the things that's sad is that it doesn't seem that even when you do get a Democratic president, that you get a lot of progressive Supreme Court nominees. You know, it's sometimes you do, but more often than not, they go the centrist route. So you have hard right, Republicans appoint hard right Supreme Court justices. Democrats tend to appoint centrist Democrats to counter them. So obviously that tends to push the balance of the court ever further to the right.
And Gorsuch was sold to people as a centrist, right, as an independent-minded moderate who would be not afraid to stand up to Trump if he did something that violated the Constitution. I mean, there was like a very intense PR campaign that, you know, I think that a lot of people were swayed by or at least partially affected by. And then he turns out to be, as far as we can tell so far, an extreme right-wing ideologue. I mean, why were some of the Democratic Party politicians, some of the senators who, you know, had a vote in his confirmation, why were they swayed or affected by what I found to be like a completely transparent PR operation?
Yeah, I was gobsmacked. I mean, a part of me thought, well, maybe they liked his qualifications and his experience, his resume more accurately, or that it was his tone. But even his tone seemed really intemperate during hearings. I thought he came off as a class A, arrogant jerk who really just didn't care what anybody thought about what he had to say. So it's baffling, actually, how Democrats who are experienced legislators and who've seen, you know, this guy's record could possibly consider him anything other than a right-wing extremist. I mean, Gorsuch's record spoke for itself. There was no subtlety or nuance there. This was not a sometimes left, sometimes right kind of guy. He has consistently ruled against the little person, in favor of big business and so on. So, you know, I think you probably see like a little more nuance in Clarence Thomas's record than you do in Gorsuch's. I mean, it's nuts. It's baffling. I mean, it was almost like they just decided to swallow the Kool-Aid. And once they decided to do that, they were pretty much going to say anything and just let the Trumpies get away with whatever they were going to say. But it was transparent, I think, to anyone who was paying an iota of attention at the time.
Is this going to embolden Trump? Is this Supreme Court decision going to embolden Trump to go further on the anti-immigrant plank of his platform? I mean, he put a lot of effort, staked a lot of political capital, I think, on the fight to repeal Obamacare. That seems to be going nowhere. You know, people talk in the abstract about tax reform, but there's been no actual proposals. I mean, there are proposals, but it's not really a coherent plan. I mean, he's Donald Trump and Steve Bannon or Jeff Sessions or, you know, the inner circle of kind of hard right people, figures, officials around Donald Trump going to look at this and say, OK, well, this is something where we can at least claim victories. We can inflict suffering on immigrant families. We can block travel from other countries. Is that the message that they're going to take from this, the lesson that they're going to learn?
Well, if I were working for them, it's the lesson I would take away. I mean, here's something, you know, they're not able to make a lot of progress on healthcare. I think the healthcare thing is going to turn out to just be one ginormous stalemate. So they have to accomplish something. And here's something that they seem to be able to do and that seems to please their base. So, you know, it's like this is what they've got. I think absolutely they're going to look at other ways to try to push the nativist agenda, and I think create a dynamic that says like we protected America from this terroristic slash foreign slash just migrant worker menace that is mostly a figment of their imaginations, but you know most Americans don't seem to be very aware of that. So, or I should say, certainly a certain segment of Americans don't seem to be aware of that.
All right. Thank you very much, Ted Rohl. We're completely out of time. We were joined from New York by award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist Ted Rohl. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker. A new escalation in Syria looks to be on the horizon, with Turkey possibly preparing an invasion of regions held by the Kurdish YPG in the northern region of Afrin. But the Kurdish forces are warning that they will put up fierce resistance. We are discussing this on our very first broadcast on 105.5 in the Washington, D.C. area. And we are joined from Washington by Connie Zulam, the executive director of the Kurdish American Information Network. Welcome back, Connie.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you make about the clashes, the skirmishes that are taking place in northern Syria around the canton of Afrin? Is this a prelude to a larger military operation by Turkey?
I mean, the Kurds are seeing this as a stab in the back as they have surrounded Raqqa, the capital of the Islamic State, and ready to bring it down, so to speak. And now Turkey is clamoring to attack them and to attack them in Afrin, which is at least 150 miles from the city of Raqqa, probably. There's also a lot of uneasiness about Russian collusion. For a while, the Russian forces visited the Afrin region, and then this morning, apparently, Turkish president spoke with Putin as well as with Trump. In the Kurdish media, at least the way it's being translated, is that he's asking for permission from the superpowers. We don't know. I mean, all I can tell you is this, that the Kurdish gains in Syria, autonomy, they cause insomnia in Ankara. Erdogan doesn't like the Kurds gaining political rights. And the Kurds, to their credit, haven't said they want to secede from Syria. They have basically a non-aggression pact with the central government in Damascus. And ideally, they'd like to be part of a democratic Syria, a post-ISIS threat, post-Islamic threat.
So there's a great deal of fog of war going on. I mean, both because of the negotiations that are taking place behind the scenes, the geopolitics of the region, and then what's actually happening on the ground in and around Afrin is also the subject of considerable disagreement. So the Turkish government said fire support vehicles in the region were used to retaliate in kind against the harassing fire, and identified targets were destroyed / neutralized, meaning the YPG or YPG-aligned forces that operate in northern Syria. But in response, the YPG said, this is completely false. The reality is unlike how they falsely claim. As I said, the Turkish state fabricates the facts on the ground using their special psychological warfare. People see on the ground that Turkey carries out attacks and shells the region. So who do you think is right here? I mean, is Turkey simply responding to fire from Kurdish forces, or are they trying to provoke something? Are they looking for a pretext?
It's really the latter. I mean, the Kurdish leadership has repeatedly said they don't want to have a fight with Turkey. If anything, they want to have trade relations with Turkey. Right now, if you're in Afrin, if you need, let's say, cement, if you want to, build your house, you have to get it through all the way Iraqi Kurdistan. It's that difficult, whereas Turkey is, across the border, if you will. If every time Turkey has, let's say, has attacked Afrin, for 10 times that they have attacked, maybe Kurds have responded once. So they don't. The Kurds are not looking for a fight. They're not really, they don't want to fight Turkey. It's not an issue that they have it on their agenda. It's Turkey that doesn't want them to have political space. It's Turkey that doesn't want them to have political autonomy. But they are, the pronouncements that are coming out of Afrin is that they are preparing for it. They have been basically free since 2012. That's 5 years. They have seen a lot of fighting in Kobani and in the other towns. And so far, they have been spared from the war, per se, even though they live in a war zone. But if Turkish government decides to either use its proxies or decides to attack with its own armed forces, which may be a possibility, it's not going to be a walk in the park. It's going to be a bloody house-to-house fight, more ferocious than what Turkey saw in terms of taking Jarablus, Azaz, Al-Bab. It took Turkey 7 months and plus its own proxies to take those towns from ISIS, the enclave that it has now inside Syria.
Right. That's the Operation Euphrates Shield operation, where the Turkish military sent tanks in, and like you said, aligned with proxy forces, were able to carve out like a wedge, a triangle in northern Syria. And it wasn't so much, in my view, about controlling that territory itself. It was about preventing the three cantons in northern Syria from being connected, from there being one contiguous territory that's administered by the YPG and its allies. Can you talk a little bit more about the geographic and strategic significance of Afrin?
Well, Afrin itself, it's a very woody area, relative to the greater Syria, which is predominantly desert. It's closer to Mediterranean. It's closer to this province in Turkey called Antakya, which at one time was part of Syria, but the French, before the Second World War, gave it to Turkey as a bribe to get Turkey on their side against the growing Nazi threat in Europe. The Kurds live south of the border, and they had, in 2012, they declared three cantons. And ideally, they wanted to unite them, but Islamic State had taken over some parts. And mind you, all those areas are not strictly Kurdish. A lot of Arabs had been settled there by Hafez al-Assad. But the Kurds, at least, were trying to unite the predominantly Kurdish villages, Kurdish areas. And it would have been a contiguous area from Afrin all the way to Jazeera, to Iraqi Kurdistan. Turkey didn't want that to happen. It felt like it would be, a Lebanon-sized country, and it would be an independent Kurdish state probably one day down the road. And it wanted to prevent that. It wanted to block that. So it managed to get the permission from the superpowers like Russia to enter, because I don't think Syria would have allowed. Syria doesn't have the power right now to stop Turkey from entering Syrian territory. But Turkey managed to get in there and to block the Kurds from having a contiguous area. And they are still there. Their proxy forces are there. Free Syrian Army is there. And now there's talk about uniting that part with Idlib and going into Idlib area, the area that predominantly has opposition forces to Saddam, to Assad. Turkey doesn't want the Kurds basically to have political space. They don't want a contiguous Kurdistan, a small, statelet, if you will, to the south of their border.
So Turkey and President Erdogan and the AKP government are fierce opponents of Kurdish autonomy or sovereignty, but they're also centrally focused. I mean, as their core strategic goal in Syria, I think, is the overthrow of the Assad government in Damascus. I mean, ever since the civil war broke out, they've been supporting opposition forces, Salafist forces, the Islamists, who are fighting to topple the government in Damascus, and the government in Damascus has its own international alliances. It's aligned with Iran. It's aligned with various predominantly Shiite political forces around the Middle East. And they're aligned with Russia, too, which has staked a tremendous amount of, I think, military and diplomatic capital on the survival the sovereign Syrian government. I mean, take a big picture look at the geopolitics of the region. If the YPG succeeds in the Raqqa battle, which it appears that it is succeeding, if it succeeds in finning off any type of Turkish aggression at Afrin, I mean, who are the winners? Who are the losers? And if you could explain how Erdogan became such a virulently anti-Kurdish actor, because that wasn't really how he oriented towards the question at the beginning of his rule, correct?
You're right. You know, when he came to power in 2002, his party, and then he became prime minister in 2003, for about 5 years, 6 years, there was a lot of, you know, to use a Russian word, glasnost, opening to the Kurdish concerns, reforming the Turkish laws, allowing Kurdish language to be, Kurdish television to be used, even though the Turkish state was controlling it. But in 2011, when the Arab Spring reached Syria, initially the government of Turkey wanted a client state. They wanted basically Syria to become a satellite of Turkey, the way during the Ottomans, Syria was part of the Ottoman Empire. And it nudged the Assad government to have democratic reforms. It wanted basically the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria to take over the opposition that was Sunni, because they were the majority. And then when that didn't work out, then Erdogan got really mad, and he allowed basically the border, that 900-kilometer border with Syria, to be crossed by anybody who wanted to fight Assad. In Turkish media, there are reports of, 2,018-wheelers carrying supposedly humanitarian aid, but Turkish journalists have found out that these 18-wheelers actually didn't have humanitarian aid. They had weapons, they had guns, they had ammunition.
And just for our listeners, what's the MIT? I mean, tell us a little bit about the Turkish intelligence forces that are coordinating a lot of this.
Well, MIT is the Turkish intelligence service. It's kind of like the CIA. It has tentacles all over the Middle East, if you will. And it wanted to, it's very closely aligned with Erdogan. The guy who runs it, Hakan Fidan, is basically a stooge of Erdogan, ideologically speaking. And so he was coordinating this aid, this so-called aid, I should say, in quotation marks. And so the opposition got armed, and not just through Turkey, but also Saudi money, Qatari money. And so Syria became what it's today, 5 million people had to leave the country. Some 11 million people had to be internally displaced. The whole country has changed completely from what it used to be in 2011. And the Kurds, to their credit, they didn't really want to rock the boat. They didn't want to be, to use a Kurdish expression, they didn't want to be the wood in somebody else's fire. So the leadership in the north, Assad decided to withdraw his forces. And so that's how some people call it the non-aggression pact. The Kurds didn't fight Assad. Assad didn't fight the Kurds. Assad focused on jihadi groups, the al-Nusra group, the Islamic group. The Kurds consolidated their gains. And then so Erdogan had the two-track plan. The first plan was to turn greater Syria into a client state. And when it failed, then he found out that, the Kurds had taken advantage of the situation and had consolidated their gains, now had a semblance of a state as big as the state of Lebanon. So he decided to basically end inside Turkey, that Syria has affected even the peace talks between the Kurds inside Turkey with the Erdogan government. In 2013, there was a ceasefire in Turkey, and until 2015, no guns were fired. The Kurds and the Turks were talking about, addressing the Kurdish issue. And in 2015, when Erdogan found out that inside Turkey he wasn't getting the majority, his pollsters told him that, he may lose the election, June 7, 2015 election, and that the Kurds in Syria, he was seeing it with his own eyes, were, having a greater say in the politics of the Syria, having support from the United States government, he decided to end those peace talks. He decided to allow U.S. to use the Angelic Air Base on July 22nd, 2015, and then he allowed U.S. troops, U.S. planes to bomb Islamic State from Incirlik Air Base in Turkey, he himself started attacking the Kurds. So the peace talks came to an end in 2015, and inside Turkey in 2016, according to UN, you know, 30 towns were turned into vast parking lots, turned into moonscape. This is a direct quote from the UN report. Cizre, Diyarbakir, Şırnak, Gewer, Mardin. So the situation inside Turkey is not good. It's very tense. Right now there's fighting going on between PKK fighters and the Turkish soldiers. And if Turkey decides to go into Afrin, which has about 1.25 million people in that province in Canton, you're going to have a quagmire there too. And I don't know if Turkey can take all this. If it's up to Erdogan, you know, he wants to take over everything. But the reality is that he cannot. People are not going to just, you know, submit to him. And so we're going to, if he indeed invades or unleashes his proxy forces on Afrin, the Kurds in Raqqa may decide to not take over Raqqa. They may decide to go back to Afrin and to fight back Turks. And it will be adding, you know, spreading butter on the bread of Raqqa, Islamic State, if you will. That's how the Kurds interpret this. That's how they see it, that Turkey is coming to the aid of Islamic State in Raqqa.
Right. The YPG is fighting potentially on two fronts. Right now, they're primarily fighting on the Raqqa front, but now there's these skirmishes going on in Afrin, and there's the potential for a wider conflict to break out. But in a sense, Turkey is also feeling the heat on two fronts as well, because there's not just the northern Syria front. Turkey is also deeply entangled in the crisis in the Gulf states, the blockade of Qatar that was led by Saudi Arabia. And I see on Al Jazeera today that there is a new batch of Turkish troops that are being deployed to Qatar that will eventually add up to 1,000 Turkish soldiers there. Is that going to be a restraining factor on Erdogan and the AKP's decision-making when it comes to military policy in Syria?
The Saudi, as well as the other Arab states, have already told Turkey to remove your soldiers from Qatar as a condition to, you know, have better relations with Qatar. Turkey is finding itself on the wrong side, not just of the, you know, the Kurdish fight for political space, but also even the fundamentalist states like Saudi Arabia in terms of their relations with Qatar. And then there's the big quote-unquote the holy war between the Sunni and the Shiites. The Turkey is on the side of Sunnis, but then it finds itself at odds with Saudi, the birthplace of Sunni Islam. And then you have the Iranian influence inside Syria, which opposes Turkish gains inside Syria. So all these things, you know, bring you to the day that, I mean, to our discussion, if you will, the complicated situation that's in the Middle East. Inside, in the Gulf, Saudis, the United Arab Emirates, they have asked Turkey to remove their soldiers. Turkey so far is saying that, you know, we have a bilateral agreement with Qatar. We're going to stay put. We don't know what that is going to lead to. It's still unfolding as we speak.
Thank you very much. We've been joined from Washington by Kani Zulam. He's the executive director of the Kurdish American Information Network. We've been discussing the situation in northern Syria, the possibility of clashes breaking out even more than they already are between the Turkish military and the Kurdish YPG forces in and around the Canton of Afrin. Thank you very much for joining us, Kani. That is all the time we have in this episode. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.